Science, technology, society, our lives, philosophy, and religion. This is Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. Even within our own solar system, planets are wildly different. Now, add in the fact that astronomers have detected thousands of planets orbiting other stars, and you really begin to appreciate how diverse the planetary zoo is. Why are planets so different? Unfortunately, since it takes thousands to millions of years to form a planet, we can't just watch planets form. So how can we hope to learn more? Today our guest is Dr. Dylan Spaulding, who actually uses techniques within the lab to see how planets form, mostly by using large cannons to simulate impacts that help to shape planets. So Dr. Spaulding, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So I see that you're interested in planets, especially Mars and Earth. What kinds of questions are you seeking to answer in your research?
Well, the biggest questions are really why any two planets are different. That goes for Mars and Earth because geologically they seem to look similar on the surface, but we're also interested in exoplanets that are being discovered increasingly now around other stars. And so one thing that these exoplanets are telling us is that we really don't understand much about how planets form or how they get into the orbits that they're in and why they have the sort of variety of geology that we see on the surface. So our experiments are really about trying to understand the diversity of planetary end states, I guess you could say. That goes for climate as well as geology, because both of those things are linked to how you make a habitable planet.
The difference in geology and the difference in atmosphere that we see in these planets, are they caused by how the planet forms and what kind of impacts that the planet survives in its formation stages?
Yeah, actually, that's a good way of putting it. We think that planets mostly form through accretion, so basically smaller things. We call them planetary embryos sometimes, or planetesimals. You can think of them as things that might be like Ceres or Vesta, sort of, or dwarf planets even. But small things like that clumping together, and they clump by smashing into each other, essentially. And if they're big enough, they have enough gravity that most of the objects essentially stick, or they might fragment and form a disk of debris, but that disk of debris might re-coalesce into a planet, and even a planet and a moon. And so really, a lot of the end state of the planet, we think, are determined by the last few big impacts that they endured. So for the Earth, that might have been the moon-forming impact. We think that the moon was actually formed by getting splashed out of the Earth's mantle. And that would have had a profound impact on the state of the Earth's interior and also the composition of both the Earth and the moon. So that the same might be true for other planets. We know on Mars, for instance, that it has what we call a hemispherical dichotomy. Basically, the two halves of the planet look very different from one another. And one of the hypotheses for that is that it might have been a giant impact that caused that difference. People are now looking at Pluto as well, now that we have high-resolution images of Pluto from the New Horizons mission. There are big patches of Pluto that also look like they may be very different than what's around them, and those may also be impact-related. Of course, not everything is the result of an impact, but we think that impacts are probably one of the most influential and sort of ubiquitous processes in planetary formation.
So basically, these impacts that we see, the evidence for, we don't actually see them happening, obviously, because they've happened millions or even billions of years ago. So in your lab, you actually have an experimental setup that we can see, sort of give us an idea of what these impacts are like. Can you tell us a little bit about your experimental setup?
Yeah. So in our lab, we have what we call a light gas gun. And basically, it's a cannon. You can think of it as the barrel being roughly the size of like a tank barrel. The whole thing is about 6 meters long. And with the cannon, we can fire projectiles up to speeds of about 2.5 kilometers per second or so. So that projectile travels down the barrel and it slams into a stationary target, which for us is usually a geophysical material, a mineral or a rock, or a mixture of some planetary materials. It could be ice. So the sample is stationary at the end of the barrel. The projectile comes flying down and impacts it. And that impact generates a shockwave. And it's actually the shockwave that we're using to compress and heat our sample. And so by doing that, we're essentially recreating the conditions that would occur in a natural impact, like a meteor striking the surface of a planet. Except we can do it in a much more controlled way and actually measure temperatures and pressures and observe material changes on the time scale of the impact.
So when we see an impact happen on a planet, do you see most of the effects on the surface of the planet, or do you see them in the atmosphere as well?
So those impacts, I guess the outcome of those impacts might depend on the size primarily, because small impacts like we actually have on Earth won't have much of an impact on, say, atmospheric conditions, but a large impact like the one that we think killed the dinosaurs might. And so by large, in that case, that was probably an impactor that was about the size of San Francisco. It was probably 7 or 8 kilometers across. So not actually that big relative to the Earth, but big enough to cause significant damage. In the lab, though, we're really studying more fine-scale processes. So the material properties on even the sort of crystalline scale, phase changes that materials undergo when you squeeze them or heat them. So we're a little bit less concerned in the lab with the environmental impacts and a little more with the material properties, I would say. But those material properties play a role in the environmental impact. It's sort of a secondary effect.
So within your experiments, you see some clear results. But how can you actually relate these results that you see within your lab to what we see in planets within our own solar system or with exoplanets? Like you mentioned Mars or Pluto earlier, and how we see that there's a little bit, that different regions are a little bit different from one another.
So the way that the experiments relate to nature is really that we're trying to measure how hard you have to smack something in order to, say, melt it or even vaporize it. You know, most people are familiar with phase changes in water. For instance, we know that water can be as solid as ice, or it can be liquid in the regular form, or it can be gas if you boil it. We're essentially trying to map out those kinds of phase relations for minerals. So we want to know when quartz, for instance, vaporizes. So what we'll do is we'll shock it to very, very high pressure, and we'll see when we turn it into a liquid or when we turn it into a gas. And we can take those results then and we can model planetary impacts, and we can see how much of a planet was heated to a given temperature and pressure for an impact of a given size. And then we can say how much of the planet would have been melted or how much would have been vaporized. And the vaporization is especially interesting because if you vaporize a lot of rock when you slam two planetesimals together, you also probably blow off a lot of atmosphere, or you might lose big parts of the mantle.
So one thing that's really interesting is that we're discovering a lot of exoplanets, planets around other stars recently. And exoplanets are difficult to observe. But one thing that we might actually be able to observe in the near future is to take a look at the atmosphere around these planets. Now, when you're setting these impacts, of course, they're affecting the atmosphere of these planets. Do you think that you could say anything about if we observe certain things within the atmospheres of these planets, we can know a little bit about how they formed?
Yeah, so if we understand especially the vaporization process, what most readily vaporizes and what sort of elements or chemical constituents are compatible in that vapor, then we can say sort of what's most likely to end up in the gaseous disk around something that's just been hit. So actually recently there have been some of the first observations of what we think might be atmospheric composition of an exoplanet. And they see spectroscopic signatures around this planet that look like they have a lot of hydrogen and a lot of carbon. And so they're speculating that that might mean it might be hydrogen, cyanide, things like that. The carbon is a little bit of a surprise, and it suggests there's probably some interesting chemistry on the surface. Because, of course, the atmospheric chemistry and the surface chemistry of the planet are likely to go together. So how you get a lot of carbon in the atmosphere is one interesting question, and that's something I think we don't really have a case study for in our own solar system.
It's kind of neat to look at astronomy and do it in the lab. It's something you don't see very often.
Yeah, that's what I enjoy about it. It's very hands-on, and you know, our experiments involve a lot of hammers and wrenches, but we're thinking about astronomical processes, which is it's fun.
Okay, well, thank you for telling us about your research. This all sounds very interesting.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcasts. If you like us, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.